Second Peter chapter 1, verse 4. It said at the end of verse 3 that he's called us to glory and to virtue. And so he's called us to a place of spiritual excellence, moral excellence, to partake of his glory. Then he says, whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises. Exceeding great and precious promises emphasizes how great the things that God has for us. They're great beyond words. They're exceedingly great. And literally, exceeding great means grandest. And it's showing that which is unsurpassed, peerless, incomparable. He has promises for us that are great beyond words, and they're awaiting his children. And then he says they're precious. The word precious means valued, prized, costly. And precious is a good translation. One source reads, these are promises that are superlatively great and of inestimable value. Superlatively great and of inestimable value. So we cannot even begin to place a value upon them, and their greatness is also beyond words. There's nothing that we can compare these promises to or with. You can note 2 Corinthians 1 and verse 20, also chapter 7 and verse 1. 2 Corinthians 1:20, chapter 7, verse 1. Then he says that by these, and it's showing that it's through these promises, that's how the Greek reads, in order that through these things, through these promises, that we might be partakers of the divine nature. So this shows where the promises are leading. They are leading us somewhere in God. It is through them that we are to become partakers of God's very person, of God's very nature, of God's very character. The word partakers means to participate in or to share in. It speaks of communion, fellowship. It demonstrates intimacy. He wants us to partake of him, commune with him. God is calling us to be partners and sharers in his very nature. And his nature involves his power, his glory, his person, and his holiness. So it is through these promises that we are to have this. It shows what the promises are leading to. It shows the purpose of the promises. God is really trying, and the devil is really trying, on the other side of the coin here, but God is trying to get across to us really what he's called us to. And we are talking about things that we know not of. It has not entered into man's heart. It hasn't even begun to enter into our mind. Now he wants to reveal in whatever way he can and to whatever degree he can what he has promised us and what he has for us, but we'll never know it completely. And even when we're there, there's still going to be much more he wants to show us. This is such a phenomenal thing. Here we are down on planet Earth, plodding along, failing, tripping, succeeding, gaining some victories, having some experiences with God, getting beat up by the devil, being tempted, worried about the rent, worried about our dating, worried about this, worried about that, woe is me, life is hard, and he's talking about heavenly things. And this is what he wants us to be viewing. And the devil is right down here saying, look at life, look at its problems. Don't you feel rotten? Isn't life terrible? Isn't it awful being down here? Discouragement, despair, frustration, impatience, this stumbling, this failing, this weakness, this sin, this temptation, this trial. And God is saying, look up here. Yoo-hoo, up here. Hey, I'm up here. Look what I got for you. Look! What are you doing looking at that? Stop studying the slugs. Look up here. And what we're doing, studying ourselves, studying the slugs. It's pretty good. Pretty good analogy. Just kind of creep along. It looked like we're ever getting anywhere. Ever watch a slug? Didn't look like the guy's getting anywhere. It's amazing. After 15 hours, though, he finally crossed the sidewalk. It's just about the way it is. Well, that's just about the way we are. Slow, slow, slow. Studying the pavement. That's all that slug can do. He knows every inch of that pavement. He can tell you all about it. Well, that's how we feel. He can tell you about pavement. We've skinned our knees, skinned our nose. You want to know about ditches? We can tell you about ditches. We've been in ditches. We know ditches intimately. But God is calling us to look up out of the ditch, to look up off the pavement, and to begin to really consider these things. He wants us to be a sharer in common with Him. That is staggering. This is really incredible. It's not that He just wants the pastor and the pastor's wife to be sharing in these things. That's how some people feel. A lot of people feel that way. A lot of people feel excluded. They feel like God is saying no to them and yes to this small, little, teeny, exclusive group. But that is not the way this book is written. It's to every single person. It's to those that will believe. It's to those that will take God's truth and they'll do everything in their power. And of course, that means being energized by God to hold to that truth no matter what. Not to let go of it. The divine nature speaks of God Himself. This shows us being made into His image and His likeness. Therefore, having Genesis 1:26 fulfilled. It's being changed into the same image from glory to glory. 2 Corinthians 3:18. It shows God opening His very divine and glorious realm to the saints. He has such a place for us. If God just showed us what Eden was like, we'd be shocked. Let alone showing us what heaven is like. We could just see where Adam was before the fall. And to see the world, the way the world looked before the fall. And the place of intimacy that Adam had in Eden. We'd be dumbfounded. We'd be so amazed. Because we look out here now, we see Death Valley, Grand Canyon, Mount St. Helens blows up, earthquakes, hurricanes, snowstorms, floods, tragedy everywhere. And we still say it's beautiful. We still say the creation is beautiful. And it doesn't even begin to compare to how it was. I'm sure that the whole face of the earth has undergone a tremendous change. That it is just completely different than how it was originally. So just to see that, we'd be staggered. We'd be overwhelmed. And that was part of this physical realm. That was part of the material realm. And He's not talking about that realm. He's saying there's another realm. And that's what He's calling us to. This pictures man sharing in the life and in the person of God Himself. Sharing in God's life and in God's person. It portrays dying to self. No longer I but Christ. Not my will but thine be done. It's gaining His heart and mind. It's becoming lowly. It's being humble before God. It's walking and living in the Spirit, living in faith, trusting God, believing God. This is following the example of Christ. Was Christ a partaker of the divine nature? Was He partaking of the divine spirit realm? Was He living there? I only do what I see my Father do. I only say what my Father gives me to say. He was in a communion with God that we don't have the foggiest idea really what it was like. But He's calling us to that same basic position of really knowing God, being a friend of God, being intimately involved with God. But see, we've got to escape this world. We've got to get free of all the entanglements. We've got to get free of these weaknesses, the failings. We've got to get free of trusting in self, trusting in one another. We've got to trust in God and His Word. There's a right way to trust in one another, and there's a right way to have, so to speak, confidence in yourself. But boy, It's a hard thing to find. We have all the wrong kind of confidence. A person knows they have abilities. They should know that. And they should realize, yes, these abilities are a good thing. But then they have to find the way to use those. And they should have a basic confidence in those abilities and a confidence in themselves as they're yielded to God. But there should be no confidence in the flesh when it's something separate from God, when it's something independent of God. He wants us to have the right estimation of ourselves. Not this low estimation when we're looking at ourselves as just the offscouring on the face of the earth and wondering the whole time how God can love us, but realize that, okay, in our fallen state, we're nothing. But He does love us. And He doesn't want us to be looking at ourselves through demonic eyes. There's a way to see ourselves in a proper humility, and then there's the demonic way to see it. And the demonic way spells hopelessness. It does not move us closer to God. It pushes us away from God. And some people know they're nothing, and so therefore they can't go to God. Other people know they're nothing, and they're going to God. One has to be demonic. One has to be the work of demons pushing them away from God. They both can't be God. They can't both be the will of God. Therefore, it would be for some to come to God and for some to be pushed away from God. That can't be God's will. He's not willing that any should perish. Then he says, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. Now, he says that here are these promises, and he wants us to be partakers of the divine nature, and one of the keys to it is escaping the corruption that is in the world through lust. Because the corruption that is in the world through lust will keep us from partaking of God. And we've all experienced this. We become partakers of the divine nature only as we flee the world. Only as we turn our backs upon it completely. This is one of the reasons that we're not partaking of the divine nature. We are only to a degree. And we can say overall, and I think it's probably a little bit simplistic, but in overall sense, how much we're turning our back on the world is how much we're going to be able to partake of the divine nature. How much we're dying to self is going to determine how much we really are walking in the Spirit, and that we're really able to partake of the things of His realm, of the heavenly realm. There's going to be a connection between the two. They're not somehow just two separate entities. But one is influencing the other. And one, as it's being accomplished, is allowing the other to be accomplished. You can note Luke 9 and verse 62. There's corruption in the world through lust. The word corruption means ruin, destruction, depravity. There's ruin, there's destruction, there's depravity. The King James says, through lust, literally it says, in lust. In the realm of lust, the carnal cravings, there is ruin. Kenneth Weiss says, having escaped by flight the corruption which is in the world in the sphere of passionate cravings. We can become partakers of the divine nature as we continue to escape by flight. That's the idea in the Greek. By flight shows a real fleeing and getting away from the corruption which is in the world. Then he said, and besides this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge. Now, when he says that we are to give all diligence, it's showing that we are to give every intense effort to make sure that we become what God wants us to become. He's showing that you here are these promises, and it's the result in us being partakers of the divine nature, but here's the corruption that's in the world, that's in lust, in that realm of lust, and it is out to destroy us. So there you see where the demonic spirits are. And it shows the realm of our lower nature. It shows the things that have come about through the curse, through the fall, and all the other things that would be involved there. And so here we see this situation. Now, what is going to get us to really be partakers of the divine nature? We're going to have to build something. There's going to have to be a foundation. And we're going to have to add to the foundation, and we're going to have to build on the foundation. Now, what is the foundation going to be? It's going to be faith. That's why he says, giving all diligence, add to your faith. So here's faith, but something has to be added to it. Virtue has to be added to it. Now, he tells us how to go about it. Give all diligence. Make every intense effort. Put everything into it. We are to give intense effort. And it's showing, the whole concept here is showing that we are to give intense effort to bring ourselves in by the side of God and His plan. Unfortunately, we don't have time to deal with the way the things are being stated here. But it shows, here's God's plan, and He's saying, now make sure you do everything to get right in, joined to that plan. Don't be separate from the plan of God. Now, what would separate us from the plan of God? The corruption that is in the world through lust. The corruption that is in the world through lust. The ruin, the decay, the depravity, the destruction. It's there through the passionate, carnal, sensual, fleshly cravings. See, the appetites formed here in this world, the love of the world. So talked about the love of the world, and in those people, the love of the Father is not found. We are to make haste, exert ourselves, so as to find ourselves by the side of what God is doing. He's talking about making every decision, taking every step in order to move in with God. It's not self-effort. It is pouring ourselves out completely in response to God's call, in response to His Word, His grace, His love, in response to the wooing of His Spirit. And then we will find ourselves there beside Jesus, beside the plan of God, involved in the plan of God, having the plan of God accomplished within our lives. And of course, it's going to be done by God's power, by His grace, by His Spirit. All diligence shows the manner in which we are to bring ourselves to God, making every effort. We've got to make effort. We've got to apply ourselves. The divine nature is not automatically some sort of self-propelling machine that will turn out a Christian life for the believer, irrespective of what that believer does. It's not that God will just come down upon us and there we are, made in His image and likeness. There's God's part and there's our part. And our part is to give all diligence, to make the right effort. Now, we have to learn how to do this. It's not going to do us any good to be running around like chickens with our heads cut off. That's not going to help. And to be filled with all sorts of anxiety and worry and fear and all those things, it won't do any good either. But a person must step out in faith, living dependent upon God. He can't go about this lackadaisically. He can't go about this just saying God will do it. He can't go about it Calvinistically. He's got to find out by praying. Say, Lord, what is my part? Show me and teach me my responsibility. Teach me how to use my will. Teach me how to make the commitments. Show me how to take your strength in making the commitment. There has to be an intense effort. There has to be a giving of real diligence, but not legalistically. Now, this is where the devil trips us up over and over again. He takes advantage of the people who really want God, and he steers them off ever so slightly. But before too long, they find out they're doing it. It's their effort, it's their strength, it's their determination, their motivation. And after a while, there they are. There's no more wind in the sail. They got tired. It's pretty hard. Here's the boat. Here's the mast. Here's the sail. And we're going to get from point A to point B. I don't think I can do it. The boat's not going to get very far. That sail is going to just be dangling there from the mast. That's it. Well, good effort. But in another sense, poor effort. Unless God blows in to the wind of that sail, there's not going to be any way that boat's going to get there. Now, in that analogy, the picture, which the part that shows our responsibility, is we better be in the boat. And we better make sure the sail's in place. And if we are in the boat, and we make sure the sail's in place, then when the wind comes, we're going to get somewhere. But just us being in the boat and having the sail in place isn't going to get us there. But there is that which man has to do. But God has to even tell him, get in the boat. God even almost has to pick him up by the scruff of the neck and put him in the boat. Now he says, get the sail in place. Well, God's got to provide the sail. He's got to give us the instructions on how to put the sail up. He probably even sends a whole crew to help us do it. So he's working right with us in this whole thing. But yet, we've got to be there. We've got to be involved in this. But yet, at the same time, unless God, by His Spirit, really blows upon that sail, that boat is not going anywhere. And I think this is really the most difficult part of living for God. I really do. I think this is the part that is the key to everything else. And I think it's the part where the devil has tripped us up the most often. And this is where he offers legalism, and it looks good. And this is where he offers the self-discipline, it looks good. And this is where he offers the striving, and this self-effort, and this determination. And he brings all sorts of confusing things on how to exercise the will. And instead of understanding the real power of the will and the importance of the will, it's now out of balance. It goes to an excess. And so then this is the solution. This is the key. The key is always going to be God. Anything that takes away from God has somehow shows the devil coming in to distort and to confuse and to deceive. But yet there is our part. And we really need to pray. We need to say, Lord, now teach me my part. Show me your part. Show me my part. And I'm going to believe you to do this. And if he doesn't, we're not going to have good marriages. We're not going to have good family life. We're not going to be successful in the ministry. We're not going to really know his word. We're not going to really have a prayer life. We can make all sorts of commitments to have these things and still not have them. Because unless God really is doing it, it's not going to be done. But yet there's our part. Now he says, add to your faith virtue. Now when he says add to, it means to supply in great measure. Here we have faith, but now add to it. Faith is shown as the very essence and foundation of Christian living. It's the beginning point, and everything else comes from this. This shows where the Christian life starts. It starts with faith, believing God. But then things must be added. Things must be built upon it. Faith is the rock solid foundation. But now we've got to build. Now we've got to add to that. It's not enough just to have faith that gets us born again. We better add to the new birth. We better keep building on that. Now you don't ever take away what was done in the new birth. You don't ever take away the blood of Christ, but you have to keep building upon it. It's always the foundation. But keep building, keep building, keep building, keep building. He says to build on it, arete, virtue. A-R-E-T-E, same word as in verse 3. He's saying now build spiritual excellence. Build moral excellence. A.T. Robertson defines it as moral power, moral energy, vigor of soul. Pulpit describes it as Christian manliness. Describes it as active courage in the good fight of faith. Okay, well, I better add some real stick-to-itiveness here. I better add some real courage. I better add some manliness. Proper womanliness. I better add these things. I better add courage. My faith, I've got to build something on that. I can't just have faith and that'll just see me through all by itself. Something has to be built on that. Calvin takes it a little bit differently. He says it talks of a life that is honest and rightly formed. And I think all of these things, plus other things as well, that we don't have time to get into, are involved here. So it's a courage, it's a firmness, it's an excellence. And it's very important in maintaining the principles of faith. We have to have courage, or else our faith is going to be robbed away. We have to have firmness, or it's going to be stolen away. And we need to have excellence. We need to become people of integrity. moral excellence, spiritual excellence, or what happens to faith? It's robbed away. Faith is not going to just stay there automatically. Things have to be done. Other things must be established. Add to virtue knowledge. Regarding knowledge, you can put Proverbs 2, verses 3 to 5. Proverbs 2, verses 3 to 5. Also Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 23. Proverbs 23, 23. The Greek for knowledge here is gnosis. G-N-O-S-I-S. It speaks of practical, spiritual wisdom, and spiritual knowledge. It is knowing. It is recognizing or understanding something. It's that which enables a man to decide rightly and to act honorably. He's talking about true knowledge. I think that he's saying, in effect, that we need true knowledge in order to give proper direction to virtue. If we're to have courage, if we're to have firmness, if we're to have moral excellence, we need knowledge then to direct these things properly. We don't want to be firm in the wrong things. We don't want to be taking courage in the wrong things. We don't want to be defending something we're not supposed to defend. There are a lot of Christians, they're firm all right in all the wrong things. They should be pliable, moldable, tender, sweet, and all of that. They're hard as a rock. Where God should be able to move them on, they're set there and they're not moving. The devil has been able to do this. So faith, then virtue, then knowledge. A living faith will lead to more knowledge in God, which in turn will produce more faith. And as all of that is working, there'll be more of a moral excellence, more of a spiritual excellence. All of this is overlapping, and it's not one, then this, then this, then this. He's just presenting it, giving an order to it, but there's not necessarily a real order. It's not first this, and then this is second, and then this is third. These things are all working together. They're all to be developing simultaneously. And they're all going back, building more to faith, making faith stronger. See, more confidence in God, deeper love, more intimacy. They're all tied together. And to knowledge, temperance. Temperance is self-control. Literally, it's one who holds himself in. We need self-control. Now, we need it with God's power. We need to be able to control our own soul. We need to be able to control our own spirit. We need to be able to control our body. We've got to be able to control our desires, our passions, and our appetites. We cannot afford to be living like brute beasts. At times, we can live just like that, in all sorts of different things, real subtle. But nevertheless, we see, I don't have control. We can see areas of our lives where, from time to time, I just don't have control. I can't seem to master this emotion. I got this desire. It can involve eating. It can involve sleeping. It can involve exercising. It can involve spiritual things. It can be some sort of a sin, some sort of a lust, sort of a weakness. It can be one of 5 billion different things. It's usually not just one at a time. The devil seems to know how to multiply some of these things. And wham! Seems like no control. This is what I want to do, but this is what I'm doing. This is what I don't want to do, but yet it's what I am doing. There's the Apostle Paul. He said, if I don't keep my body under daily, I'll end up as a castaway. He knew that he couldn't do it as a Pharisee. Phariseeism never helped. He had to do it by the power of God. God's power makes it possible for us to properly rule ourselves. We need God's power. We need God's truth. So that we're no longer serving self. We want to be able to be running this ship. We don't want the ship to be running itself. You ever feel like the ship is running itself? Or that somehow some pirate has come on board and he is there at the helm? Those demonic spirits? You ever notice the old man isn't quite dead? You ever notice the carnal nature stick its old ugly head out of the coffin and say, "Yoo-hoo, I'm still here, feed me." Ever notice that? Boy, what a frustrating thing. And you got to rebuke the frustration as well. You know, you get frustrated by it. That's no solution. That's a door to demons. So you've got to deal with the problem and now deal with a new problem. The demon that knocks and says, you want some frustration? I mean, that would be a proper way to react, wouldn't it? Doesn't this seem reasonable? A lot of times we say, yes, that does make sense. So another problem's added right on. Amazing the situations we find ourselves in. But that's the way life is. And it keeps demonstrating how much we need God, how much we need His power. Add to temperance patience. Hupomone is the Greek word for patience. H-U-P-O-M-O-N-E. It's a long E. Hupomone. It means to remain under. It speaks of endurance. Perseverance. We must endure in self-control. We must go through the tests of life patiently and steadfastly. We must persevere under the commands of God. We cannot push God's commands aside for self-gratification. Trench calls this the brave patience, which lets nothing adverse force it to give up. I'm not going to give up. And it's connected with true self-control. And it's that which will fortify us, protect us, and hold us in God. We've got to be held true. So there's things we're going to have to stay under. And if we don't stay under it, we're going to be in a position where we're actually rebelling against God. We'll be in submission toward God. A couple of verses where this is translated patience. Luke chapter 21, verse 19. In your patience possess ye your souls. Hupomone. We've got to endure. We've got to continue. And then also Revelation 3 in verse 10. And some of the time you'll find the word translated as to endure, other times as patience. But it shows persevering, continuing. I've got to continue. Now add to your patience godliness. Godliness is shown here in the Greek to be a humble reverence and a deep piety toward God. It speaks of a God-likeness. The Greek also shows that it's a worship and how it's to be directed toward God. And so it shows a giving of self to God. It shows a proper honoring of God. So it's involved in this. See, we're looking at a godly conduct, a godly attitude, but how is that really going to be accomplished? By worshiping Him, by honoring Him, by directing our thoughts and our heart, directing all of what we want toward Him, just putting ourselves there at His feet. See, it involves a dependence upon God. As man recognizes his need for God, then more of God will occupy that man's conduct. Bullinger says that the Greek word relates to real, true, vital, spiritual relationship with God. So it's showing a relationship with God, which produces what? God-likeness. It makes us more into His image and in His likeness. Now what do we add to this? Brotherly kindness. The Greek is Philadelphia. It means to have a tender affection for the brethren. This is what the Philadelphia church is all about. A proper discerning of the Lord's body. We must be free to give ourselves to our fellow saints. We must realize that we cannot really love God unless we love the brethren. That's exactly what we saw in 1 John chapter 4, verses 20 and 21. Then we're to add to this brotherly love, charity. In the Greek is agape. A-G-A-P-E. It's a long E. And this is the crown of God's work. This is man loving God as God loves him. That is, self-sacrificially. 1 Corinthians 13, 13. And Galatians 5 and verse 6. We can see in this that the ladder of Christian development, the step-by-step process, must culminate in this deep, intimate love. Now, the love is developing all the way along. But he wants it to reach a final point. And that's where it's a bride love. And that's when he'll be able to take us home. And that's his goal. It should be the goal of every Christian. That is to really love God. It shows the Christ life culminating in brideship. That is the goal. That is God's plan. And he says, "For if these things be in you and abound, they make you that ye shall neither be barren nor unfruitful." And he says in verse 9, "But he that lacketh these things is blind and cannot see afar off, and hath forgotten that he was purged from his old sins." God wants these things to be superabounding. That's what the word abound in verse 8 means. It's used in the sense of superabounding. He wants all of these virtues, that's how we could describe them, or characteristics, he wants them to be existing, and he wants them to be multiplying. He wants them to be overflowing. If they're overflowing, the idea is that we're not barren. They're being brought forth. They're pouring forth out of us. So we're not unfruitful, and we're not barren. When he says he doesn't want us to be barren, the Greek means idle or inactive. He says, "Ye shall neither be inactive. Ye shall neither be idle." That shows that we'll be used of God. It shows that we will be effective. It shows that God's will is going to be accomplished and will be accomplished and is being accomplished. Unfruitful means without fruit. Not yielding and producing what it should. He wants us producing. He wants us bringing forth. Now the concordant reads for verse 9, For he in whom these are not present is blind, closing his eyes, getting oblivious of the cleansing from the penalties of his sins of old. That's very interesting. For he in whom these are not present is blind, closing his eyes, getting oblivious. Now the phrase "cannot see afar off," the Greek is muopazo, muopazo, and both O's are long O's, muopazo, muopazo, and it's used of one who is able to see only by constantly blinking his eyes, and it's not to keep from seeing, but in order that he may be able to see. See, he has a myopic condition in his eyes, and it's rendering him unable to look directly into the light. He can only see by blinking, and he can't really look into the light. He can't open his eyes completely. He's having to close his eyes. The point is, he's hindered in his vision. Distant objects are to him indistinct, and he sees only what is near. It shows one who is terribly deficient spiritually. He cannot see. He can only see the things about him. Now, what happens if we only see the things about us? What are we going to see then? Just ourselves. Our little teeny spheres that we live in. The little teeny realm that we live in. We're going to just see the world and its affairs. We must have the power to look beyond the temporal to the eternal. This person cannot see afar off. He's no longer able to see what is distant. without a vision, the people perish. So he tells us in the book of Proverbs. A.T. Robertson says that it limits blind. See, he's not really totally blind. But this word limits blind. It gives qualification to the word blind. Showing one blind as a short-sighted man, screwing up his eyes because of the light. It's just too bright. Shows that he loves darkness rather than light. See, it's a spiritual picture. And it's something that happens to people physically. It really happens to people's eyes. They can't take in the light. So they can't see anything far away. They can only look at things right here close. Well, that's what happens to people spiritually. And so, in effect, they're blind. Not really blind, but in effect they're blind. Because they can't see what really is important. The person would be blind so they couldn't drive a car. You can't just look at the steering wheel to drive a car. You got to be able to look past the car more than 3 inches. You got to be able to see what's going on. So in effect, the person's blind. Not really blind, but in effect, blind. That's the way a lot of people are. They say, I can still see. They can't see. All they do is see what's right there around them. So that means in the temporal realm. It's right here in the earthly realm. This person then hath forgotten that he was purged from his old sins. Now literally, hath forgotten is having received forgetfulness. Isn't that interesting? Having received it. It shows the individual accepting the forgetfulness. He wants to forget. It shows what the demons have done. The person is once again being trapped by sin, and he is wanting excuse for the sin. It's one thing to get trapped in old sins. It's another thing entirely to make excuse for it. Now, when we get trapped and we sin, we usually have made excuse so that we could do the sin. There's been the rationalization. The devil's been right there. But once the person has sinned, if they continue making the excuse, then the situation gets more and more serious. Once they've stumbled, they've got to immediately admit they stumbled. They've got to throw all excuses out the window and just say, Jesus, forgive me. I messed up again. Lord, I don't know what all the demons are here, but I know I sinned. I don't know what all the problems are. I don't know what all the pressures are. I don't know all the things that are involved here, but I know one thing. I have just sinned. And Lord, I'm sorry. And I need you to forgive me. And I need your strength. I made excuse, and I know the devil was helping me, so I went right down this path, and wham, I'm sorry. But Lord, forgive me and get me out of it. And help me so I don't keep falling into this thing. But if the person makes excuse to sin and then continues in the excuse making, that's really serious. The one's serious, but this is even more so. So when the person wants to forget and wants to put things out of their mind and go back to what they had in their old life, they're in a lot of trouble. It's a terrible thing. See, he's adopted an attitude of forgetfulness toward his former obedience. He doesn't want to think about obeying and following God and believing God. You know that the devil's involved here. It's terrible folly. But it shows him. He decided to forget. He decided to go this way rather than this way. It shows the power of darkness taking a hold on him. Little leaven leavens the whole lump. We're going to sin. That's just plain and simple. But we better keep doing the right things to get out of the sin. And then we more so have to do the right things so we don't sin. But once we start to make excuses, then we know that we're getting trapped. There's a deception that is coming. And if we really accept that, it can be very, very dangerous. Once you've sinned, we've got to repent. We've got to get up, trust in God. And then we've got to pray about the matter and say, Lord, help me. strengthen me in this thing. I've got to get through this thing. And the first thing you do is you think, I'm going to get through this thing today. I'm not going to give into this thing anymore today. That is the absolute truth. Don't be thinking about, I'm not going to do this thing again for the rest of my life. Let's be realistic. Let's be practical. Let's not be idiotic about this thing. Don't play into the devil's hand. Don't do that. It's not going to help. He's going to use that against you. You're looking at it the wrong way, really, at that point. Say, Lord, I'm going to get through the rest of today. Then I'm going to get through tomorrow. And we're going to just do this a day at a time. And I'm going to look to see and ask the Lord to help me to see what things start to come my way that cause me to be susceptible to this. What kind of situations during the day? Where are my weak periods during the day? People have to begin to recognize this in dieting. They have to recognize this with certain sins. They have to recognize it with certain ways they react. They've got to see, oh, now it's in this circumstance. It's with these kind of people. It's after this kind of a day. So I need the Lord to help me to recognize what's going on. And I need His strength then at that point. And I better be prayed up at that point. And I better have my Bible near at that point. Or I may need a certain counselor to be available. Somebody to pray with me. Some people, they know, okay, in this situation, I'm going to be weak. I just know I am. And it's the truth. They're going to be weak. And they need somebody to be their strength. They need the Lord to be their strength. They need God's Word to be their strength. And they may need a brother or sister to be their strength. And so sometimes you need to have somebody you can call up. When it starts to get serious and the pressure's there, you need somebody to call up. Can you pray with me right now? And that's what a lot of people need at different times along the way. And there's nothing to be embarrassed there at all. There's no reason for us to be embarrassed by that. It just shows we're human. And it shows we're being attacked by the devil. And it shows we're finally going about it the right way to overcome the devil. And some things I know we could just kick ourselves in the seat of the pants and just kind of get out the nearest whip and start clubbing ourselves. How could I do that again? But we did it. And it's not going to do any good to become spiritual flagellants and start whipping ourselves and beating ourselves and laying on nails and walking on broken glass and laying in the form of the cross and the Hail Marys and the rosaries and the lit candles and the sprinkling of water and the confessional. That's not going to do us any good. Forms of godliness aren't going to do us any good. We've sinned. There's only one thing to do. That's to repent and to make an appeal to the blood of Christ, to the work of Jesus Christ on Calvary. And now it's to look at what's going on. Now, what sets me up in this thing? What gets me trapped in this thing? Where does that frustration come from? Where does that discouragement come from? Where does that emotion come from? And to begin to really pray about those things and look at those things. Of course, easier said than done. But nevertheless, it's what we're all having to work at. We're all having to work at it in different situations, to differing degrees, depending on who we are, how we're being attacked by the devil. The devil knows how to come up and give us the old sucker punch. He's the old guy that here you are in the duel where the two, you know, the guy comes up and slaps him on the face with his glove, and he takes the guy's glove and does it back, you know, and then they go out there at the pistol duel, and we're like this, and the devil's here. And instead of him walking this the opposite way, he turns around and aims the gun right at our head. And that's the way the devil, that's the way he fights. So he's not going to fight fair. So we're going to have to find out how to defeat him. And only God has the power to defeat him. And God has shown us the way to defeat him. But we're going to have to give some thought to this. We're going to have to give some proper meditation to this. Meditating upon the Word of God. That means really giving it thought. Spending time before God, waiting upon God, saying, now, Lord, I keep stumbling on this point. What's getting me? What things are taking advantage of me? Now, I can't continue with this. This little bit of leaven is going to blow me up. This yeast is going to cause the dough to just expand, and boom, there goes the whole oven. That's me. I'm going to be destroyed. I've got to get rid of this. I've got to get this leaven out of here. This is not what we need in baking the bread. We don't need two jars of this leaven. It's not going to help things. This is not going to work right. So, Lord, help me. I need your help. We've got to realize that these things are life and death. They're not just fun and games. We're talking about desperate situations. That doesn't mean push the panic button. It just means do the right things. Get the counsel. Get the prayer. But we all have to take it seriously. I got this problem. I got to do something with this problem. I can't continue in this thing. I can't have this secret sin forever. I can't. This thing I'm not going to be able to keep in the closet forever. This is going to be the monster that devours Los Angeles if I don't get this thing killed. If I don't find the way to club this thing to death, it's going to eat me up. It's going to destroy me. And that's really the truth. But you don't go into despair, because then that's playing into the devil's hand. We have to keep going back to the cross. And then we say, now, Lord, show me. Show me how I've been set up in this thing. Give me insight. Give me revelation. Help me to know what I'm rebuking. I feel like I'm rebuking the thin air. And rebuking the thin air isn't getting me very far. Who's doing this to me? What's the strategy involved here? Help me to know. Help me to understand. But even if I don't, help me to have more faith in you. And no matter what's going on, no matter what I'm feeling, even if I can't really understand it, I'll turn to you. So what we have to do in this thing, it's a very serious matter. He says, wherefore the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure. For if you do these things, ye shall never fall. We want to make sure we never fall. Kenneth Weiss translates it, wherefore, brethren, exert yourselves the more and bend every effort to make your calling and election sure. The words give diligence are the same as in verse 5. And the Greek is spodazo, S-P-O-U-D-A-Z-O, S-P-O-U-D-A-Z-O. That second O is a long O, making every effort. The word election is literally the act of picking out from a number. So God picks out. He's calling and picking out. He's picking out those who will respond. The calling is made to all. The election is only to those who respond to the call. God calls all, but then who becomes the elect? Those who respond. Those who respond become the elect. Then he says, for if you do these things, you'll never fall. Literally, for doing these things, should trip sometime. It's a double negative in Greek. If we will do these things continuously, it's present tense, for doing these things, that's present tense, for if you do, the word do there in Greek is in the present tense, continuous action, we will not fall. We will not trip, is what the Greek is, to stumble. It can carry the idea of falling into misery. And the Greek is aorist, meaning not even at one point. It shows that we don't have to fall even at one point. Now, I know that's absolutely beyond comprehension, and it looks like we're a million miles away from that, but he wants us to know that's his call, and he's given us the provision. Now, see, if he said, now, I have called you to sloppy living, that means there must not be much power in God. Because if he called us to sloppy living, and that means we're to be like him, that means there must not be much to God. He must be rather puny. He must not have much holiness. So that would be a proper conclusion. If he called us to haphazard living, that means he must be about the same way. That means there wouldn't be much to him. He has called us to that which is absolutely beyond comprehension. It's the highest calling. No science fiction writer could ever have come up with something this amazing. This is incredible beyond words. It's fantastic beyond words. It puts everything that man has ever thought of or everything that man has ever written about his idea of utopia, it makes it look like the garbage dump. It makes it look like, we're down in some skid row gutter. That's the truth. That's all man can come up with. And so then if he says now he wants us to live a certain way to be fit for that, to be made ready for that, then that tells us there's got to be a lot of power in God. Because he's talking about something that no man can create, no man can produce, and he's saying he wants to make us into that image and likeness, partaking of his glory, his nature, That tells us there's the power to do it. But it's only in Him. So it's a phenomenal call. He doesn't even want us to trip at one point. That means there's got to be great power in God. That means there's got to be tremendous availability in the realm that He lives in for us to be able to walk this way. It's got to be available to us. It has to really be there in such a way that it is tangible. It can be done. And that's why the life of Christ is so important, because He did it. So he's using this to get across to us that, yes, it's a high calling. Of course it's a high calling. But I can do it. I can do it in you and I can do it through you. I just need you to trust me. Now let me build upon faith. Let's put faith down as the foundation. Let's build upon that. And then let's, as we're doing this, let's give forth every effort. Keep making yourself available. And I'm going to make sure you won't fall. I can guarantee you won't fall. That's what God says. No man can pluck you out of my hand. No demon can pluck you out of my hand. He wants us to have real confidence in Him. Okay. We have our... let's see, when do we have our test? We have our test tomorrow. Okay. So, 1 John. Test tomorrow.